Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, we have a conversation about taste, my favorite subject. Let us know, speaking of taste, what you think of our new intro music written, composed by Scott Miola, a friend and composer, and someone for whom taste matters in all sorts of stylish things. He's also the art director of the James Beard Foundation. Anyway, we're very grateful to him and his musical talents. Today, speaking of talents, we are talking about a subject that is very, very, very close to my heart as a cookbook author and someone who believes in the value of cookbooks beyond cooking. I'm really pleased to have with me here Marvin Taylor, who is the director of Fales Library and the Special Collections at New York University, which some of you may or may not know has one of the most important collections of cookbooks and food-related materials. There is. Thank you for being with us, Marvin.
Well, thank you, Mitchell. Thanks for having me.
And you're here particularly to talk about a new book about cookbooks, a meta cookbook in some ways, which I think is a very unique object and important object. It's called 101 Classic Cookbooks, and it includes 501 classic recipes. But let's talk about the first half of this beautiful, heavy book, which is 101 Classic Cookbooks. Tell us a little bit about the project and why you saw it important to undertake it, which I know was a large undertaking.
Sure. There's been a desire, I think, in the food world, especially in the food studies world, for a canon of cookbooks, but right. No one could quite come up with it or figure out exactly how to go about doing it. Enter Rizzoli, who does mm-hmm. 101 classics of the 20th century. And so,
as a series.
Uh-huh. And one of the editors there, who does the cookbooks series, and they're doing reprints of cookbooks, asked Florence Fabricant if she would be interested in doing 101 classic cookbooks of the 20th century, American cookbooks. And Florence didn't have the time. And so she said, you should go talk to NYU. And so the editor, Chris Steigner, came down to one of our critical topics in food events that Clark Wolf hosts. And we met him, and he spoke with Clark, and Clark said, we should do this. And Marvin should be the one who helps out. So we put together a committee of about uh-huh. 30 people, including yourself.
Me?
And Ruth Reichel, Michael Pollan, Marion Nessel, on and on, sort of... the best minds that we could get together to think about what were the 101 great cookbooks or classic cookbooks. They're not necessarily the best cookbooks.
Right. Well, I would like to talk about that in a moment. Right. Sure. They are the classic cookbooks.
They are the ones that changed the discourse about food in mm-hmm. the 20th century, from Fanny Farmer up to Thomas Keller.
Mm. And that is, in fact, the trajectory.
That is the trajectory. We
from
snuck
F to T.
Yeah, we sort of did the long 20th century because Fanny Farmer is 1896. But how could you not start with Fanny Farmer? I mean, she was so important for so many things about food in the 20th century.
And so, what I mean in your mind, forget the advisory committee. We can talk about that. What makes a cookbook a classic? You said it changed the conversation about food in some ways, but are we talking about how people eat? Is that the conversation, or how people cook, or just what is in the discourse around food?
I think it's both how they eat and how they cook. Mm. Interestingly, as I look at the 100, because I went into writing the entries for each of them without any trajectory, without any knowledge, any idea of what's mm-hmm. going to happen here, I realized that the committee chose cookbooks that marked specific moments in a history of what happened from Fanny Farmer to Thomas Keller. Basically, I think we created an American cuisine. We had one before that, and it's interesting that people like James Beard, Cecily Brownstone, Clementine Paddleford were interested in trying to determine what American cuisine was as opposed to French cooking,
right,
and how important that was. That seems to be the trend of the 30s, 40s, 50s.
Right.
Then comes Mastering the Art of French Cooking in 1961, and it demystifies French cooking for a whole lot of people, and it actually gets many, many people interested in cooking in general. Following that, a series of other ethnic cookbooks, as they were originally right. called, come out in the early 70s. And Mexican, you get Diana Kennedy.
Right.
You get
Paula Wolfert.
Mater Jaffrey. And they all come out within the first 4 or 5 years of the 70s. And suddenly those cuisines, which had been limited to urban areas where there were populations, start to spread far and wide. And then later you see Thai coming in. You see all of the regional Italian dishes start to come in. Spain, you also get Spanish regional foods. So we start to put together of the diverse diet that Americans eat, which is probably more diverse than just about any other place in the world, because there are so many influences on our cuisine. And then with someone like Thomas Keller, at the end, he does these witty, almost postmodern riffs on traditional recipes. Right.
A little bit back to French in some ways.
And I think one of the things that we did is we applied French technique to all of these cuisines. Mm. I think certainly I'm thinking of the very highest restaurants, sort of the best food out there. It's all based on French technique, but it then is using different kinds of ingredients. The 80s seems to be the moment when there was an explosion of new ingredients.
Right. It's so funny that you went to that moment of the 70s, because what struck me when I was going through the book page by page, and I would tell everybody listening, this is the perfect gift for anyone who loves cookbooks, because it really is, I mean, it's a coffee table cookbook. Like it's a funny place. It's startlingly illustrated with pictures of pages and the covers of the books, and then of course there are the recipes at the end. But when you're flipping through, what struck me was that 70s was a time of mastery that perhaps Julia Child ushered in, because those are still the definitive books on those cuisines. I don't know if that's a historical moment or a cultural moment or both, but you know, when you reach for when you want to know the definitive way to make couscous, you still go to Paula Wolfert's book, even though 100 Moroccan books have been written since. Is there something culturally? I know that your interests go beyond food, and certainly the collection that you oversee at Fales has a much broader cultural moment. Do you think there's something about that time that resonates with those authors and that book and that period for us?
Yeah, food? I think there really is. You can't underestimate the importance of the hippies and the hippie movement, because without it, we wouldn't have Alice Waters. We wouldn't have a lot of things. We wouldn't have an opening up to a whole variety of other interesting cuisines. And we have 3 or 4 important hippie cookbooks in there. It's not just Miss Wood.
Laurel's. I saw Laurel's Way, or the vegetarian book.
Alicia Bay Laurel. Right. There's something about that moment that there was an opening up of culture in general that I think made these possible. What I also think is going on there is you had Beard and Craig Claiborne tapping people who were experts in certain areas and encouraging them to write these cookbooks. And Claiborne did that many times. And so I think that they were encouraging them in the 60s. The product then in the early 70s, just at the right moment, was these definitive cookbooks, which have almost a sociological approach. Certainly Kennedy's does.
I'm going to remind people listening that if you have any questions about the classic cookbooks or any cookbooks, or perhaps suggestions that you think ought to have been part of the 101 classic books, you can email us at info@heritageradionetwork.org, or you can tweet us in 140 characters or less. It better be a short cookbook title, at Taste Matters HRN. So the hippies, that I've never quite thought about their contribution to food, and yet there we are. Let's talk a little bit about that, because I think that when we imagine Alice Waters as she's become, not as she was exactly, you know, we think about her as some great chef who's descended down, but in fact there's a different history that I think speaks to America's love of learning, autodidactism, if that's a word, especially when it comes to food.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And what I found looking back at Fanny Farmer, and especially thinking about Laura Shapiro's work on Fanny Farmer. Fanny Farmer was perhaps the most important feminist who was never a feminist.
Oh.
She probably wouldn't have considered herself in alignment with the suffragists, etc.
And they wouldn't have her probably because she was in the kitchen, which would be hard too.
Precisely. Yeah. On the other hand, she was an activist for someone who's trying to improve the lives of women, especially lower class and middle class women who were cooking in large houses. I mean, that she and the other women started cooking schools to, you know, to help these women out. There's been a strain of activism within American thinking about food for a very, very long time. Mm. And I see that as something that really defines our approach to food that's different from the way Italians think about food. And it sort of disappeared a bit mid-century, but the hippies brought it back very, very strongly. And I think it really informs how we think about food today, how we eat, even the restaurant we're sitting in, the notion of local organic produce, you know, of ethically raised animals, et cetera, et cetera. Without that hippie return to the land to a certain extent, we wouldn't be where we are. Of course, Marion Nestle comes out of that tradition too. Funny. So there are a lot of people who, you know, I wouldn't have thought that had I not worked on this project and seen, oh, yes, these are very, very important things. And this makes perfect sense because it's part of a longer narrative that about Americans and food. Even back into the 19th century, we have a lot of early cookbooks in the collection. And you see Americans worrying about, well, just what is American food? Where does it come from? And it has to do with our identity at some core, in some core way. What is American that isn't British or German?
Right.
And then, of course, then the elephant in the room, of course, is French cuisine, French cooking.
Right, which is why anyone's even asking the question in Precisely. Some ways. It's a question we grapple with all the time at the Beard Foundation when we, you know, for a large event, ask chefs from all over the world to participate. Or you look at the chefs at our, we had a great big gala last Friday for our 25th anniversary. And now I'm going to have to think in my mind, not all of those five chefs were born here or learned to cook here. And yet they have become icons of American cuisine. Marcus, no, who was there? It's going to forget Alfred Portale. I guess he's American. Maybe there, but you know what I'm saying.
It's
a funny thing. What role do you think cookbooks play in that process? Because food is always, has been historically denigrated in part because of its temporality. It just disappears and who cares and we all have to eat. And yet the cookbook is sort of that the object that endures when we're talking about food or has been for a long time.
Yeah, it's the place where we write down those cultural moments, and it's the place where we go to study those moments historically. And it's interesting that in the 101 Classics, most of them are very much geared toward documenting a moment in culture. Mm-hmm. They teach you how to make recipes as well, but I think the very best ones, and this is something that Judith Jones has said, is the very best cookbooks provide a narrative about food that we accept, that we buy. We listen for the voice in these cookbooks. That's what's really, really important. And, I'm on the internet all the time. I'm not somebody who goes out and looks for a recipe and then goes and gets the ingredients and makes it. I read cookbooks. And over time, recipes end up in my head. I tweak them a little here and there to make them my own. But it's that narrative of, it's Julia Child's voice, which I hear so strongly in those books. Or Beard. You know, some of the books which I refer to again and again. And so that's something I think that's important.
I love that idea of there being a running narrative because to me, at least, one of the reasons for this show and the fact that I focus on taste is that narrative becomes taste. Like, we learn how we believe things are supposed to be in the head notes, in the descriptions. These days, I think even at judges' table on Top Chef, when people are debating sort of what the ideal is because of what they're eating. And yet I think that's a very powerful process, especially when it comes to taste, which is so amorphous.
It may be that cookbooks are more important in the U.S. than they are anywhere else because our food tradition is so vast and different, and we don't learn from Nona.
The
perfect way to make this bread or the perfect way to prepare this pasta. And so that they may serve an even more important function for us. And because they expose us to all the different facets of American food.
Right. Well, it's very interesting. So we're going to think about that for a moment and take a brief break. We're talking with Marvin Taylor, who's the director of the Fales Library and Special Collections at New York University, but also the editor and I guess the producer of 101 Classic Cookbooks, a new book that chronicles the history of great American cookbooks.
You
You're listening to Favorite Flower by Pamela Royale on heritageradionetwork.org. Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the heritageradionetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and I'm talking about cookbooks today with someone who is surprised to find himself an expert in the subject we were just talking about at the break, Marvin Taylor, who is the director of the Fales Library and Special Collections at New York University. Let's talk about cookbooks beyond this 101 classics. In something that you mentioned earlier, in this modern era when so much of the internet is devoted to food in a way that I think has probably surprised Mark Zuckerberg and everybody who had anything to do with it. It surprises me, and I'm obsessed with food. The fact that I tweet a picture of something that you can't eat, I don't have the recipe for, and you want to know about it. It's a funny moment. How do cookbooks fit into that? Or what's different about finding a recipe to make tonight, which you may or may not do, versus having a book of recipes or even a book of cookbooks?
I think that the internet is for a certain kind of cook who needs a specific recipe. They sort of know what they want, and they're going to go out and buy the ingredients to make that particular dish. I don't tend to cook that way myself, so I'm a little perplexed why people would want to have that on their, have an iPad on their kitchen table instead of a book that's open. But I think that it's more about the narrative of the cookbook. It's more about learning about food that comes in with cookbooks as opposed to just preparing
a dish.
And I think that there's something different about that. Americans have tended to like cookbooks that are compendia. Uh-huh. And there's like a long succession of the Buckeye cookbook, the White House cookbook, the Finally Farmer, The Joy of Cooking, and probably now I would say Mark Bittman's How to Cook Everything, which I think is that. And so there's something about that is very particular to how Americans think about cookbooks. It's almost like an encyclopedia that we have.
Right.
And so we go to those things. I think one of the things, especially about Joy of Cooking and about Bittman's book, is it's the voice, the quirky voice of Marion Cunningham.
Yes.
Irma Rombauer and Marion Rombauer Becker was in fact part of the what made that cookbook so important. That and the fact that it came out in 1931, when most women had lost their cooks because of the Depression.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it's one of those interesting points that why not only was it this great voice and it was very easy to make the recipes, but also it comes out at just that cultural moment.
So it's Thanksgiving week here, and that's probably the foodiest food week in America, where so many people, even if they love food or they know nothing about food, are going to be making a big feast for people. Should everyone have these 101 cookbooks, classic cookbooks, on their shelf? Is that the point of this, creating the canon, or is there something else going on there?
Well, certainly there are a lot of other cookbooks that are out there that are very, very interesting. Mm-hmm. These are ones which it's pretty interesting. The committee was unanimous about probably 40 or 45 titles. Because what we did is we compiled a list of about 150 titles that had won awards, that had been reviewed, that were just in the popular mindset are important cookbooks. We sent it out to the committee and said, yes, no, maybe, and what's missing? Uh-huh. And so we ended up with about 200 cookbooks that were mentioned as really important. And it fell out pretty easily around. There was only one no that somebody mentioned.
Can you say that?
I probably shouldn't.
You don't have to say who said it. What was the no? No? Okay, yeah, forget it.
And they... but there were a lot of maybes, lots. And so Clark Wolf and I sat down and I collated everything. Uh-huh. And then we came up with, like, oh, okay, so there are three Indian cookbooks here. Which one is actually the most important?
Right.
And so it was a very fascinating process to see how much agreement there was.
Sure.
Among people who were on the committee.
So why don't you, that's a good segue to talk a little bit about the Fales collection itself, which I think is unique and perhaps underknown,
sure,
if that's
sure.
a word.
Sure. The Fales collection itself is the history of English American fiction. And Mr. Fales was a lawyer here in New York. His family was from Boston. And starting in 1908, he built a collection on the novel at a time when nobody else was collecting the novel, so really. Funny. And it's interesting because he offered the collection to Harvard in 1956 because they were all Harvard men. Mm-hmm. And the whole family. And Harvard turned it down because it was a fiction collection.
Amazing.
Because that prejudice against fiction as popular entertainment from the 18th century was still very much in action in the academia in the 50s.
Can you imagine if he had asked to give them a food collection in the 50s?
Precisely. when Marion Nestle came to me and said, you know, there's this great food collection of Cecily Brownstone's books, and we need it for graduate students doing work here in the food studies program at NYU, I said, sure, let's go do it. But there was some pushback institutionally at the beginning because it was a food collection, mm-hmm. and that prejudice against food was there. But today we have 55,000 cookbooks, and it's the largest collection in the U.S., and they're used really heavily. And it's really fascinating to see how they're used. People don't come in and just read one like they do with a novel.
Right.
They come in and they request 25 books at a time. And it's interesting because that's sort of what I do with my own little collection at home. Okay, I'm thinking about this. This bluefish is absolutely perfect today.
Right.
What am I going to do with it? And so I go to all of my books and I sit down and look through. And then I inevitably get lost reading other things in them. And
And is it open just to NYU students and faculty, or can other people use it?
No, other people can use the collection. They just need to make an appointment with us. But Mr. Fales wanted his fiction collection open to writers. And so we've kept that that sort of mindset about the food studies collection and our other major collection, which is the history of the downtown New York art scene.
So let's tell people how they can make an appointment.
Absolutely. If you send a note to fales.library, and that's fales.library@nyu.edu, that's how you can make an appointment to come in and consult the collections.
Okay. So back to the 101. Were there any surprises for you? I mean, I don't know if you had any preconceived ideas of what that list might be when you started. I'm thinking, because there's a great new exhibit that just opened last weekend at the Museum of Natural History here on food called Our Global Kitchen, and there's a wall of cookbooks there, and they're very different books. James Beard is there, and we're very proud to have him up there, but they're different important books, obviously different missions there. But
it's interesting. I probably have only about 7 shelves of cookbooks at home, because they're the ones I use all the time. Mm-hmm. And I actually keep it curated that way, because if I start collecting at home, it'll be crazy. Besides, I can collect for the library. But most of the latter half of the 20th century, it was pretty, I understood those. There was one by Robert Delfs, The Cooking of Szechuan. That's the first Szechuan cookbook, 1974. I did not know that book. It's a really wonderful book.
I didn't know it either. I saw it on that list. I didn't recognize it.
And it's right at that moment when Americans sort of start eating Szechuan cooking, which is now sort of taken over, or a version of Szechuan cooking has taken over Chinese cooking. Also, there was a Thai cookbook from 1983 that I didn't know, but it makes perfect sense because Thai food, I would have maybe placed it in 93 instead of 83, but there it is. So that was interesting. Most interesting thing for me were the early cookbooks, because I did not know those. I knew Fanny Farmer, I knew The Joy of Cooking, but I didn't know Mrs. Dull some of those that were really interesting. And the recipes look great, I have to say.
Right. That's a funny thing. You think that with the way we've eaten has changed and we've opened our eyes so much, and yet even at becoming intimate with James Beard's collection of work, I'm just startled at that he ate how we sort of eat. I mean, more butter and perhaps a little bit less emphasis on some newish things, right. But sun-dried tomato. He loved sun-dried tomatoes in 1950, like, and I thought we found them 10 years ago, yes. You know?
Yeah, it's interesting looking at the early cookbooks up to the war, to the Second World War. We had a much more diverse diet. Oh. Than we do now in terms of the kinds of things that we ate. Rabbit was very, very popular. Mm. Everybody had a hutch out back. And the war did away with that, plus probably industrial agriculture. But we eat a lot more beef than we ever did. There were many, many more fowl that were possible and really? Their recipes. And you just don't see recipes for that in modern cookbooks at all.
No, which is as much a function of modern cookbook editors as it is of how people eat, which is a whole other aspect of change represented by this list of books. What was allowed and what isn't allowed.
Oh, precisely. People don't hunt in the way that they once did as well. It's an endlessly fascinating source of cultural history, looking at this list of cookbooks, and realizing that each of them is representative of probably 1,000 other cookbooks out there that are similar, but these are the ones that bubbled to the top over the years.
And is your sense that we'll continue? To me, I've seen some changes in my short time in this frame in the way books are produced. When I first wrote my original cookbook, Cook Something, which was 15 years ago, there were cookbook editors there who refused to do chef books on principle. Chefs were not home cooks and they didn't care. And now you can't pick up a book that doesn't have a picture of a chef on the cover. Where do you think we're going? I mean, you've looked a lot at the past, but what do you think's happening now?
Even Rizzoli knows this, and Chris Steigner said this on a panel that I was on with him. It's lifestyle. That's what cookbooks are becoming. They're becoming coffee table books. The Thomas Keller book is a perfect example of that. It's lavish. It's exquisitely illustrated. It's very beautifully designed. The recipes are, of course, they're fabulous, but he's got, 30 sous chefs yes. Who can help make these things? Clark Wolf is fond of saying that right now we want comfort food from restaurants and we want to make the really elaborate dishes at home.
Right,
because we've now got batterie de cuisine and we've got big stoves and everything is stainless steel. When men entered into the kitchen, suddenly stainless steel appeared as well. And so it's very peculiar in that way. Is there a place for the more traditional cook's cookbook as opposed to a chef's cookbook? Sure, I think so. But we have this other kind as well.
Right.
And they're selling.
Well, all books have become objects to assert their value in some ways. Like, Rizzoli and Fiden produce these lavishly illustrated photography-filled books, I think, because that you can't capture online. You can't read that on a Kindle. That's exactly what a Kindle isn't.
Yes.
The opposite of that.
That's very true. And, there are more cookbooks produced every year than any other type of book except one, popular romances.
Oh, funny.
And so I have a feeling that many, many things will go over into the digital world that used to be in print. But I have a feeling that cookbooks like the romance are going to be around. It's going to be the bitter end.
Right.
At least I hope.
And then there's the 50 Shades of Chicken, which is a romance book and a cookbook, which has recently there were apparently half naked men at Penn Station handing out butcher twine to it's great. It's an interesting moment in time. Do you have another book in you about cookbooks? I'm just wondering, or is this sort of,
maybe down the line. I have two or three other projects I'm working on, which aren't related to food.
Tell me about them a little bit.
I've been working on the history of the black leather motorcycle jacket.
Oh.
And what it symbolizes about American masculinities. It's something I've been fascinated with.
And I've seen you sport one on occasion, yes, so that's nice. Yeah.
There's one of the growing areas in academia is the study of fashion.
Oh.
And again, an area that was underlooked, that was, is always thought of as somehow suspect.
Of course.
Not unlike food. And our collections turn out to be very rich in terms of that study. And so, that's a project that I'm interested in. I think it would be a wonderful exhibition.
Sure, of course.
That's something that I'm thinking about right now. In terms of food, there's a really wonderful book that's just come out. It's also 101 cookbooks of earlier cookbooks. And so I'd like to do more work with those prior to 1800 even.
Well, we will look forward to both of those. How about eating in a motorcycle jacket? Yeah, we can combine both.
Yeah. Biker Billy Cooks with Fire. This is our biker cookbook.
Okay, there you go. Well, thank you so much, Marvin, for joining us here in Bushwick on Taste Matters. Next week, Karen Karp is going to be guest hosting the show. I'm sure it'll be a fascinating conversation. In the meantime, have a wonderful Thanksgiving, everybody. Eat something delicious, and why not buy a new cookbook?
Very good. Thank you, Mitchell.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.